Okay, we'll start now. It's good to hear all the talking going on because it really means that you're connecting with other people, which is really some of the goals of some of these events. My name's Bill Konstantinidis, and I'm the General Manager for Product Underwriting and Actuarial at Covermore, which is recently a Zurich-acquired company. So Zurich are our new owners. I'm not a young actuary, but I think I'm young at heart, so... With the actuarial profession undergoing rapid changes in regards to job opportunities and education, the actuarial skill set will only expand and diversify. This plenary aims to provide insights into the tools, the techniques, and the pathways that a young actuary must acquire to drive their career forward, whether it's staying in a traditional role or trying out a new role in a non-traditional environment. I think from my personal view, I think the key, and I think you'll see this from some of our speakers, is it's really about diversification of your skills, getting new skills in different areas, whether that's other areas, other countries, or other sectors. And I think you will see that through the presentations today. There will be Q&A, but please save your questions to the end. And of course, please put your hand up and wait for the microphone because we have people on the webinar. And they really want to hear the question as well. And the questions from the webinar attendees can be emailed to the webinar at actuaries.asn.au. So those online, feel free to send them through, especially you people in Brisbane, okay? I used to work up there, so. Well, I'd like to introduce Solei Veliappan. Solei is an advisor for startup companies, so that sounds very exciting. She's specializing in finance, data analytics, strategy, and risk management. Previously, she had been an actuary in a non-traditional area in actuary on non-traditional areas, including general insurance, and she's also been editor of the Actuaries magazine. She's a fellow of the Institute of Actuaries and a chartered enterprise risk actuary. I'd like to invite Solei to the podium. Thank you.
Good afternoon, everyone. So today I'm going to talk about my story and the three areas I've found useful in how I've moved directionally in my career. I'll also caveat that I'm actually bound by quite a few non-disclosure agreements with all the companies I'm currently working with. So if there's anything a little bit vague, you know why. But ultimately today, I'd like to explain my story so you can find some ideas and you can adjust them and adjust your own takeaways for your own next steps in your career. So I graduated from UNSW with a Bachelor of Commerce. I majored in Actuarial Studies and Finance. And I started as a graduate at Zurich. I spent a couple of years in pricing and then a couple of years in reserving. At the same time, I was sitting exams and I was building my character by failing and then passing and then failing and then passing exams. So the exams took quite a consuming headspace process for me personally. And I got into this vortex of intensely studying for 3 months, and my mindset would always be, okay, I'll postpone it to after the exam or when I qualify. And then reality set in, and qualifying was not going to be straightforward as I thought it would be. And so it led me to this really big question. Why should I wait until I qualify to try something different? So the next steps were thinking of how to go about it and what exactly I would like to do. So here are just three examples. I've categorized them in order from being nervous to paralyzing fear. And now in hindsight, they weren't that bad, but at the time they were a really big deal for me. So the first one I've got up there was to volunteer for the Actuaries magazine. I thought it would be a really good way to stay across the current issues and trends. My experience as an analyst at the time was a lot of number crunching And I'd get involved in a little bit of writing, you know, in the half-yearly pricing review or the annual ILVR or FCR. But I thought this would be a really good way to work on my writing skills. And then the GI conference was a way that I thought I could improve my presentation and my public speaking skills. And applying for the strategic assistant role to work for the CEO was just to go completely outside of my comfort zone and grow in terms of dealing with different stakeholders. So naturally, for each one of these, I thought of reasons of not to do any of them. And that's when you should really counter those thoughts in what I like to call safety factors. So for the magazine, there's a group of editors and their other supportive actuaries. They're also volunteering, and collectively there was a common goal to curate articles worth reading for the actuarial community. And for the conference, I had a co-presenter who had quite a bit of experience, and if anyone has met Dimitri, then you'll know what I mean. And so I could lean and learn from him. And the CEO-related role was within the same company, so it was at Zurich, so I wouldn't be starting from scratch. I knew all the lines of business from pricing and reserving. Now it was just a matter of applying all that knowledge in a different way and for a very different boss. I've felt that all of these moves have really paid off and helped in crafting and enhancing the skills I'd like to work on. The strategic assistant role truly opened my eyes to how my actuarial skills could be applied in a non-traditional way and how valuable those skills are viewed by others. So this is a pretty good segue to my next point, which is exposure to diversity of thought and thinking. If I think back to when I left university, the first 5 years of my career, between uni friends, colleagues, and mentors, they were all actuaries. It's not a bad thing, just an observation of the early days of work. Over the last 5 years, I've been in roles where I've reported to non-actuaries or been the only actuary in the wider team. So the makeup of my colleagues and mentors have naturally expanded. Also, many friends from uni are also changing their career paths and they're moving away from more traditional roles, so it's further diversifying. Some of my hobbies over the last few years have included meeting people who occasionally ask what an actuary even is. So it's really pleasing to explain the type of work we do. Once you can demonstrate to those who never knew what an actuary was before, they become your biggest advocate in asking for business advice. The strategic assistant role was my first introduction to a vastly diverse role. I was in the middle of coordinating strategic matters on behalf of the CEO between 8 to 10 executives, who all had a responsibility for a different area of the business. This ranged from underwriting, finance, legal, HR, operations, IT, risk, and claims. It was such a unique position, and you could truly see how leaders of different disciplines make decisions and the type of information they need and the way it needs to be presented to inform those decisions. This was a great learning for me, an appreciation that everyone didn't have the same training as actuaries, so they consume and analyse information differently. This isn't good or bad, just a point to be aware of. Learning about the fluidity of dealing with different stakeholders is now definitely helping me lately, especially as I've stepped outside of the insurance industry. What has surprised me the most is that my network has been the most powerful enabler of unique opportunities. So after the strategic assistant role, another executive offered me a role to work in the deal management team, which looked after captives and multi-line deals for the global corporate risks. Again, something very different and nothing I had done before. And then a few years later, I noticed many of my friends were starting their own businesses or working in the startup space. I would chat to them and it was quite clear that my skill set could definitely help them with the problems that they needed to be solved. Actuaries have a really good skill set in that we're very analytical, we're good with numbers, we have a good understanding of data, which is becoming more and more important, and general business skills to connect the dots and commerciality in mind to provide valuable advice. It was also good timing in my personal life. So once I decided to take the leap to start working with a startup, it soon snowballed to working with quite a few different companies. They range from aerospace and asteroid prospecting, property and infrastructure, and consumer services. Many of these companies, they're quite small. They don't have the luxury of a big corporate where you're able to hire specialists for every task required. So there have been many times when I've been working for one of these companies, you'll have a few different roles or projects or perhaps traditionally outside of your scope. Or you may be involved in something you have zero prior experience in, which is when you have to learn and get up to speed very quickly, which leads me to my next point. Can you all just raise your hands who's still studying? I just want to get an idea of, okay, so quite a few people. Okay, so good news. There will be a day when you are not just reading textbooks and doing past papers. But even if you are still studying, there are many resources you can utilize. As I mentioned before, some of the projects I've been working on, I've had zero experience in or understanding of the industry even. So, and sometimes speed is of the essence to absorb the material over a compressed period of time. So here are three groups of mediums I now enjoy utilizing as resources. So we've got some books, podcasts, and the occasional documentary. I've put up just a small sample within each category. It's not just always technical material you need to get up to speed with, but often the nuances. So in the books category, the themes in these examples are strategy, growth, negotiation, how to be organized, influencing, and leading projects. They're high-level concepts, but each book here gives some great examples of tangible ways to execute the ideas. For me, with these types of books, they take about a month or so to read and digest, and this is how I make bigger directional changes in how I operate over time. With the podcast category, the themes in these examples are tech, how to build companies from the ground up, and scaling. So Rico Decode is one that I like to listen to a lot because it's about the latest tech that's coming out of Silicon Valley, and this is quite important to be aware of because soon after they come to Australia. The other three are stories about different industries or issues and how the founder or team solved a particular problem. I think podcasts are a great soundbite, and these examples range from 30 to 60 minutes, so they're perfect for the commute. I've found them really useful to learn about a particular industry or even about, or to note trends about what other startup companies encounter at a similar stage. It's always good to learn from others before. Why make the same mistakes? The final category is documentaries. The themes around these examples are hot or controversial trends and corporate governance and ethics. I don't watch documentaries that often, but sometimes it's just nice to sit on the couch, watch some Netflix, and justify it as work. And just like diversity of your network, the resources you consume should also be diverse. You never know what you can learn from other areas or genres that you can apply elsewhere. So here are some examples within each category that I've found really interesting and enjoyable. There's probably some debate as to whether The Crown is a documentary, but I really enjoyed it. So everyone is different, and each of your careers will be different. So I've thought about some actions you could take personally within each category. Not exhaustive, of course, but just some ideas. So in the taking calculated risks, you could be analysing a new line of business or being put on a new project or taking on a new role you think would challenge yourself or that you could grow into. Or maybe it's to volunteer, whether for a working group or the committees, there are plenty with the Institute, or for a not-for-profit that you're really passionate about. Perhaps you'd like to work on your presentation skills. I know many companies have a lunch and learn, and if they don't, maybe you can start it. Exposing yourself to different thinking. This is about expanding your circle and making different connections. You never know where these connections may lead. Perhaps there's a new hobby you'd like to take up or attend a meetup on a topic that you've always wanted to learn more about, or to seek out a mentor, whether in your own industry or somewhere else, or maybe even from both to help advise and give you their views of their own experiences. And finally, harnessing your curiosity. We are very fortunate that we have so many resources at our fingertips. It's important to remember you don't need to have a master's or PhD about every topic to provide a view or incorporate it into your advice. So if there are any gaps you identify, you can always fill it in multiple ways. Books, blogs, podcasts, perhaps an online course, or when in doubt, Netflix. So thank you all. I wish you all in your future endeavours. I hope my own story has given you some ideas for the next steps of your future career, and I look forward to the Q&A.
Yeah, thank you very much, Sally. You worked for Zurich as well. Wow. That's, yeah, I feel like I'm bookended from all angles, being recently bought by Zurich. And now we have another speaker from Zurich. And I'm not sure why people with the longest resumes only have the shortest resumes on the, they'll have to read out. So anyway, I suppose Mark Henderson is the Chief Financial Officer of Zurich Life and Investments of the Australian business and has been in the role since April 2015. And I suppose the recent acquisition of OnePath from ANZ must keep you a bit busy lately. You joined Zurich in 2006 and held various positions in finance, including appointed actuary and regional chief life actuary at Zurich Asia Pacific. If I can welcome you to the podium, thank you.
Good afternoon, everybody. Firstly, I'd just like to say a special hello to the guys from Zurich who are podcasting in. So hi, guys, and thank you for listening. Thank you, everybody, for the opportunity to talk to you this afternoon. I've been asked to talk to you about my career so far as an actuary who has stayed within a traditional area and has moved through actuarial roles and is now in a senior management position. So this afternoon, what I'll share with you are what skills I think have been important to me in my career journey so far, and also how I pick them up, because it's not always obvious. But firstly, a brief introduction to me. So that's me. I'm on the middle of my kids there on the picture on the right. So that's Claudia on the left with the fair hair. I used to have hair that colour when I was about three. That's Juliet on the right-hand side. She's got the same colour hair as my wife, Veronica. And that's my son, Thomas. He's 13. So I've got three kids, 13, 10 and 7. And I'm pleased I've still got some hair. That photo was taken on my 46th birthday, so I'm 47 this year. The photo on the left is me doing one of the things I enjoy, which is playing soccer. That's a Zurich team. It was an 8-a-side, 7-a-side competition we played in last spring. And I'm the guy looking tired at the top left. I think I actually was more than twice the age of some of the guys in that team, but I was still kicking goals, so you can't complain about that. I do like sport, though. Sport's important. I do like music. Music's important. And throughout my career, I think it's been very continually important to have a couple of things that you do for yourself, away from work, away from home, and it helps have a healthier mind, and if you can take time out from things for a while. So just keep that thought in your mind. Since uni, I've worked for a few companies, and what I'll do today is talk you through my career in those roles, but more importantly, share with you some of those key takeaways and learnings I've come away with. I'd like to stress to you guys, though, that these are just my thoughts on my career. So, of course, this might not work for everyone here. Indeed, it may very much not be what you all want out of your careers. We're all different, and so that's why you're hearing from Salai and you're hearing from Mung as well. So don't forget that. We're all different, and we all have different aspirations, and what works for one of us or some of us may not work for all of us. So uni and early career. So I grew up in the UK. I'm originally from a town called Birmingham in the middle of the UK. I support a soccer team called Aston Villa that hopefully a couple of you might have heard about. Probably not all, though. I did physics, maths, chemistry at school in my A-levels. So I had a science, maths background. And then I got a position at Oxford University as as an undergraduate, to study something called PPE, which is politics, philosophy and economics. So I know you're probably thinking, so why is he standing up here talking about actuarial stuff? But I did. And actually, that's the cover of the Trinity College prospectus that appeared whilst I was at the university. And unbeknownst to me, they had taken that photo as I was walking through the chapel quad. So that's me very early one morning. It's about 10 to 11. Not realising that I would be on the front of the college prospectus. So there you go. So with this degree, I then managed to obtain a graduate position in an actuarial role. And in my early 20s, I worked for a life company called Royal Sun Alliance, and I'd moved to Australia by this time. Here I was surrounded by some great people. There was a guy called Richard, a lady called Helen, a lady called Trang, a guy called Sean, another guy called Peter, who actually won a Prescott Prize, believe it or not. And these guys have gone on to have great careers, whether remaining as real experts in their field or in some very, very senior roles. And some of the things I took from my time at Royal Sun Alliance was I felt immediately respected by the whole actuarial team within that company, and even as a student still sitting exams. And I think one of the reasons for that was the positive way in that company that the actuaries interacted with the rest of the business. And it did also help that our CFO, Richard, was an actuary. But there were no ivory towers in that place, and that's really important. An important thing to remember, it's very easy, being an actuary, to think that just because you know more about the numbers than anyone else, that you actually know more about everything else. And that's certainly not the case. And I think the sooner you appreciate that, the sooner you appreciate what everyone else in the company brings to the table, the better. In my opinion, the best actuaries and the best students are those who realise early in their careers that they need to engage with the people in the business and take a real interest. So, post-qualification and overseas, next business card. So I set my final exam and qualified as an actuary in 2000 and moved to Ernst & Young. You can see the logo's changed since then. This really is getting old, isn't it? I had the opportunity to work in Sydney and in London with Ernst & Young, which was terrific. And I'd say consulting is probably a little bit more technical than being in a corporate. That's my opinion. And rather than engaging with a business, you find yourself doing typical consulting tasks like auditing and reviews. But at the same time, in a consultancy, you have a better opportunity to learn early on about managing small teams. You meet a lot of people. You're working with a larger team of more similar like-minded people compared to being in a smaller life office. And you can specialise in particular areas. And I do remember our practice leader in London, a guy called Tim, challenging us all to become famous for something, get known and become famous for something within the team, which I think is a great thing to ask yourself sometimes. I'd say overall, and this is only my view, that the best consultants, though, are those who've worked in a corporate at some point in their career. They're able to better put themselves in the client's position. And I'd also say that having worked in a consultancy with the broader industry footprint it provides, that's also a good footing for a broader career in a corporate, and I've certainly found that. So moving on to Zurich, some more business cards. You can see Zurich hasn't changed its logo for a while. I ended up working at Zurich, who were actually my client at the time, and early on I worked in a couple of actuarial roles, managing bigger teams before becoming the appointed actuary. Some key takeouts for me through those roles were the importance of having that respect for the rest of the finance functions outside actuarial. A lady called Suzanne taught me that. And as I touched on before, it's easy to be dismissive of non-actuaries' contributions just because you know more about a very narrow thing. And it's a big mistake to make, especially as you become more senior and you'll find in your roles that you're engaging more with those broader teams. It's also important to have a respect for those in the actuarial team who don't want to develop their career any further. And those people who are very happy being a complete expert at what they know. I know that I will never be as good as those guys at what they do, absolutely not. So I do respect those talents and how they contribute to the collective, and I respect their decision to remain doing what they're doing and not wanting to manage people or lead teams. It's not what everybody wants, and let's not forget that. On the other hand, don't always assume that everybody knows as much as you do. There were many important things I worked on when I was where I was the expert, and I was very fortunate to have a couple of people give me feedback to that effect. Some very senior people, in fact. One person I remember well was one of the executive directors from Europe who sat on our life company board, a guy called Jim. Very early on as appointed actuary, I can remember presenting to the board our bonus recommendations. I was pretty nervous. I remember chatting to Jim afterwards, and he gave me some great feedback. He said, Mark, it's clear to me you know your material. You know it better than anyone else here in this boardroom. So sit closer to the middle of the table when you go in there. Don't hide at the end. Get your head up out of the papers and look around at what's going on, because there's some very experienced, very knowledgeable people in that room, and learn from their experience. So it's a good piece of advice, great feedback, great advice to receive. And this applies to any meeting with senior people that you find yourselves in. Based on Jim's advice, there's a funny quote that I often think as I walk into our boardroom. Have you heard of Oscar Wilde? He was a Victorian playwright. He said some funny things, but one of them he said was, I'm not young enough to know everything. And I encourage you to think about what that quote means, because it's actually quite a good one. So on to some senior roles with Zurich. So in 2012, I became Zurich's regional chief life actuary based in Hong Kong. So myself and Veronica and the kids, we moved to Hong Kong for 3 years. Some of you may be able to read my business card on the left. Some of you just blame the resolution on the screen. But the guys in the team very kindly helped me find a Chinese name. I think a couple of them told me it meant noble warrior or something like that. But I think if you look carefully, it means, I think it's the character for career and a character for trust. But we can talk about that afterwards. But In 2015, I was then fortunate to return to Australia as CFO of Zurich's life and investments business. And some learnings I've taken from those senior roles are you can't do everything yourself. So you will need to rely on others as you become more senior and you start managing teams, or you start managing people who manage their own teams, who manage their own teams, etc. You just can't do everything yourself. And if you can't let go, you'll really stress out. So there's two points here. Though, with a strong technical grounding from my early career, I still have a good instinct for the numbers, and that's important. So even though you can't do the work yourself, you're relying on other people to do the work for yourself, it's still important to have what I sometimes call that sense of smell. And I think if you talk to any senior actuary, you'll find they've got that. And I'm sure you'll find that coming in your own careers even now as you're starting to review the work of more junior people. And the other thing is, because you're more reliant on others, it's really critical to be able to recruit and retain the best people. So really do treat people, I think, with respect. Offer people challenging work, because I think that's what's most important to people, and that's certainly been my experience. And then inevitably as well, as you become more senior at work, you're becoming older and you have more family commitments, and work-life balance can become a genuine issue. Particularly as work is interesting, it is fascinating, but family is your family as well. So I have a test that I try and apply as much as I can, where you should ask yourself some simple questions if you've ever got a clash between what you think is an important work commitment and what really is an important family commitment. So I'm sure you've found yourself in situations where there's an ultra important report at work, or there's a very important meeting you need to prepare for. And I remember finding myself in those situations, but also at home, it was my son's first day at school the next day. So I would encourage you in those situations, ask yourself, what will I remember in 10 years' time? And it's a pretty easy answer, isn't it? So I can certainly remember my three children's first day at school, and I must confess, I cannot remember what the important reports were that I finally managed to get done. As you move into senior management as well, you will become a member of an executive team, and you're inevitably surrounded by non-actuaries and non-financial people. So one of the last things I wanted to talk about briefly was learnings I've taken from recent roles. And one of those learnings is the ability to express financial outcomes in ways that non-experts can understand. This is so important to what I do now. And it's especially important if you find yourself needing to influence people to make what you know needs to be the right decision. I often say to my finance team, my finance and actuarial team in Zurich, that it's hard as a finance team to gain a good reputation amongst the business, but it's very easy to lose it. But as well as that, we can have the best processes as actuaries, we can have the most accurate numbers with no surprises and produce things on time. But in my mind, we've failed in our role if we can't communicate these outcomes, these numbers, to the people that matter, to members of an executive team, to directors in a board who may not have a numerical background, to our shareholders or overseas visitors, and to the rest of the business. So it's really an important skill to be able to explain things simply, or to be able to produce a table or a chart that people can look at once, just once, and understand. And that's not always something that our actuaries or accountants can do as well as others. So it would be great if we could. As we are actuaries, we already know the numbers and the concepts, and it's a shame to me if others end up being seen as the owners of those outputs just because they can communicate them better when they haven't done all the work to produce them. So I would encourage you all to pause and think before presenting any work you do up the line, especially to non-numerical people, and just take that time to challenge yourselves to see if you can present that work even better, especially if it's to non-actuaries. So mindful of the time, and it'll be great to have time for questions, so I'll finish there. I really appreciate you listening to me, and I really hope you've got something out of my brief talk, and wish you all a good afternoon. Thank you.
Thank you, Mark. That was very interesting. The next speaker is Meng Wan. As far as I know, she hasn't worked for Zurich. but she might surprise me. Meng is an actuary with 10 years of consulting, corporate and government sector experience. She began her career as an actuarial consultant at PwC, where she worked with traditional actuarial techniques across a range of general insurance portfolios and across a number of different clients. She qualified in 2012 and relocated to Dublin, where she joined AIG as a general insurance actuary. Being part of a small team in Ireland, she gained a thorough understanding of the Irish business and provided actuarial advice to management to assist with the decision making. In her role as a director at the National Disability Insurance Agency, the NDIA, Meng is passionate about applying her actuarial skills in a social policy context and is proud to be part of a groundbreaking scheme aimed at bettering the lives of people with disability. I think that's very noble. So come to the podium. Thank you.
Hi, everyone. Today, I'm going to be talking about my journey to the NDIS, the relationship between actuaries and the NDIS, and finally, some personal reflections. Throughout our career, we are presented with many options and directions, and it can be overwhelming to decide what paths to follow. As an actuarial graduate, the typical choices are between corporate and consulting, life and non-life, and conventional versus non-conventional practice. My own journey began at PwC, where I practiced general insurance consulting. Like many would experience with their first jobs, I sort of fell into the role after enjoying a summer internship there. At PwC, I was exposed to many interesting projects and a wide variety of clients, and made lasting friendships and built strong working relationships. But after 4 years, I was ready for change. A desire to understand how an insurance company actually works, coupled with a curiosity to experience the world, led me to beautiful Ireland, where I joined AIG as a general insurance actuary. But it wasn't until I returned home 2 years later that I truly learned to adapt to change. It was 2014 and the National Disability Insurance Agency was beginning to unfold, with some of my former colleagues from PwC forming the now Office of the Scheme Actuary. I joined without hesitation, seeing it as a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to be a part of a revolutionary disability reform. The NDIS has been variously described as the biggest reform since Medicare, a groundbreaking innovation, and a startup on a large scale. And it is all of these things. So how is it relevant to the world of an actuary whose work is typically within an insurance context? Or rather, how is an actuary relevant to disability reform? But first, a brief history of the NDIS. In 2011, the Productivity Commission conducted an inquiry on disability care and support. It found that Australia's system of disability support was inequitable, underfunded, fragmented, inefficient, and gave people with disability little choice and no certainty of access to appropriate supports. The Commission recommended a new national scheme to provide insurance cover to all Australians in the event of significant disability. The new scheme, the now NDIS, represents a shift from a block-funded system to a person-centred national approach, where the decision-making lies with people with disability and their carers. The Commission's recommendations on the national scheme were largely accepted by Australian governments, and the first four NDIS trial sites commenced from 1 July 2013. By 30 June 2016, after 3 years of trial, the NDIS was operational in 9 locations across Australia. The transition to full scheme began in earnest on 1 July 2016, when the scheme began to ramp up at a significant pace to achieve ambitious bilateral targets within a very tight timeframe. To give you a sense of the scale of the scheme and the pace of growth, here's a chart that shows the number of participants in the scheme with an approved NDIS plan. As you can see here, after a 3-year trial period, we had 30,280 participants in the scheme. This then tripled over just the first year of transition to over 90,000 participants. And now, in our latest quarterly report, which was publicly released just yesterday, we reached over 150,000 participants as of 31st of March 2018. This will then triple again over the next 2 years to reach an estimated 460,000 participants at full scheme. Now back to the relevance of an actuary. Well, the answer lies rather obviously in the name of the scheme, the National Disability Insurance Scheme. The fact that the NDIS is an insurance scheme is often ignored, yet it is one of the key pillars of the scheme, alongside choice and control, and community and mainstream. That is, the NDIS is an insurance-based scheme that funds reasonable and necessary supports for Australians with permanent and significant disability to help participants live as ordinary a life as possible, including care and support to build their skills and capabilities so they can engage in education, employment, and community activities. These pillars are embedded in legislation, which also actually prescribes the relevance of an actuary in the scheme. Section 3 of the NDIS Act says that the objects of the Act are to support the independence and social and economic participation of people with disability, to provide reasonable and necessary supports, including early intervention supports, and enable people with disability to exercise choice and control in the pursuit of their goals and the planning and delivery of their supports, and promote the provision of high quality and innovative supports that enable people with disability to maximise independent lifestyles and full inclusion in the mainstream community. These objects are to be achieved by adopting an insurance-based approach informed by actuarial analysis. And finally, in giving effect to the objects of the Act, regard is to be had to the need to ensure the financial sustainability of the NDIS. So what is exactly the relationship between insurance and the NDIS? Consider this. The risk of disability affects all Australians. The NDIS is a way of pooling these risks. Each year, Australians pay a premium in the form of tax to cover the annual costs of the care and support needs of participants and the costs of running the scheme. The NDIS takes a lifetime approach to the provision of services and supports, with a focus on early investment to enable people with disability to live an ordinary life and participate in the social and economic life of the wider community. And finally, an insurance approach is based on data and evidence. The NDIS data is monitored closely to ensure the scheme is financially sustainable. So let's take a moment to compare a typical insurance environment to the traditional disability support system and to the new NDIS approach. In an insurance system, the unit of management is a claim under a contract of insurance on the occurrence of a rare and usually costly event. The insurer guarantees that valid claims will be satisfied, regardless of the size or number of claims that emerge. Insurers therefore face significant financial risks and go to great lengths at trying to manage the uncertain financial outcomes. In disability support, the unit of management is any person with a disability, but there is no insurance contract as such. Prior to the NDIS, the traditional disability support programs have resulted in unmet need for disability support because they have been underfunded to meet the support needs of all people who might require support. These disability systems have been able to deny support or only partially satisfy disability support needs on the basis that the cost is more than can be afforded under their capped budget. As a result, the traditional disability systems have enjoyed certainty over their costs. However, compared to insurance, many units of management are unfulfilled. This has led to significant social and economic cost. Under the NDIS, the unit of management is any person with a disability, as with traditional disability support systems. However, unlike traditional disability support systems, the NDIS commits for the first time to the provision of reasonable and necessary supports to all eligible participants. It is not open to the NDIA to refuse to fund supports on the basis that the budget has been exhausted. The NDIS therefore faces significant financial risks in the same way that an insurer does. However, as well as managing uncertain financial outcomes, the ultimate focus of the NDIS is on participant outcomes. And it is this concern with people rather than claims that sets it apart from a private commercial insurer. So here are some familiar concepts to anyone working in an insurance context. The NDIS uses similar risk management tools, but applies them in a different way. In the interest of time, I won't go through everything on the list, but we'll just pick a few examples. An insurer will set tightly worded policies. The NDIS Act sets out the eligibility criteria for participants. It also specifies that the NDIS will fund reasonable and necessary supports. Together, these provide a broad parallel to an insurer policy wording. An insurer is required to set aside money to pay for claims that have not yet been finalised. Some insurance claims can take many years to finalise. As a result, the necessary reserves can be a significant multiple of annual claims payments. The NDIS is generally cash flow funded and will not hold significant reserves. However, it is an essential tool for NDIS governance to project and monitor the expected future expenditure of current participants, a requirement of the scheme actuary. An insurer takes a risk management and injury management approach to claims management. This is absolutely key for the NDIS. First, it must ensure that it only admits eligible participants. Second, the processes and decisions around individual packages represent the single most important financial risk management tool that the NDIS will undertake. Related to this, the NDIS must take a risk management approach to claims management to achieve positive and sustainable outcomes. And finally, both insurers and the NDIS adopt a control cycle operational framework. For an insurer, the control cycle approach provides feedback and therefore continuous improvement to its pricing, reserving, and claims management systems. For the NDIS, the control cycle approach provides feedback and therefore continuous improvement to its resource allocation and participant support and planning systems, to the scheme funding decisions undertaken by governments, and to the statutory reporting requirements of the scheme actuary. Importantly, participant outcome is a critical component of the NDIS control cycle framework. Therefore, finding the right balance between participant outcomes and cost is what defines financial sustainability in the NDIS context. Specifically, financial sustainability in the NDIS means two things. One, that the scheme is successful across a range of measures, including independence, economic and social participation of participants, and participants accessing enough money to buy goods and services to allow them reasonable access to life opportunities. And two, that contributors believe that the cost is and will continue to be affordable, under control, represents value for money, and therefore remain willing to contribute. The NDIS insurance approach allows pressures on the scheme to be identified early and management responses put in place to respond to these pressures. Specifically, data is collected on participants, including the characteristics of the participants, costs and outcomes, and this actual experience is compared with the baseline projection. The annual financial sustainability report, a requirement of the scheme actuary, is a key document in managing financial sustainability. At the beginning, I talked about options, directions, and choices. In my relatively short career to date, I have sought change and experienced different perspectives. Yet in seeking change and different perspectives, I have found fundamental commonalities. The context within which you work might be different, but the fundamentals are the same. The link between insurance principles and disability reform is an example of the broad application of the actuarial control cycle, the key to managing uncertainty, the bread and butter of our trade. So how does this realisation translate into practical advice, if you like? Perhaps the apparent options, directions and choices are not separate and competing paths, but are merely various stages of the one learning path. I call it the three stages of learning. The first stage is the foundation stage. I truly believe it is vitally important to build a solid foundation early on in your careers. Get stuck into the SAS codes, play with the assumptions, build models from scratch, write that report. There is no elevator to success. You have to take the stairs. It pays off to put in the hard work. The second stage is the curiosity stage. Experience the world. Have fun. Try something different. Get out of your comfort zone. Adapt to change. Create change. Although I've come to realise that fundamentals don't change, it is only through seeking change that I've come to this realisation. And the third stage is what I call the purpose stage. At some point in our career, we ask ourselves, what is the meaning of what we do? Seeking job satisfaction and fulfilment become more important than financial reward. Ultimately, it is in the search for purpose that my path crossed with the NDIS, where I can use my actuarial skills to serve a social purpose. Now, when I discussed this theory with a more experienced actuary, she suggested that this in itself can be regarded as an actuarial career cycle. Indeed, as we try new things and discover ways we can make a difference, we realise how much more there is to learn, and so the cycle continues. I will end with a story and a piece of advice given to me that changed my way of work. Now, bear with me, the story is a little bit long, but I have to explain the context for this to make sense. When I joined AIG in Ireland, the company was going through change, where its functions became centralised, and an actuarial central office was established in London and in New York to replace the localised actuarial functions. In Ireland, the long-serving chief actuary consequently left the company along with his entire team. Local management in Ireland, having enjoyed the services of a respected and experienced local actuary, were desperate for this to continue, and frustrated that the London actuaries knew and cared very little about the Irish business, given its relatively small size. And this is where I came in. Based in Dublin, I was to fill the huge vacuum, that is, all things actuarial, expected by local management, and reporting to my managers in the London office who had other ideas for what I should be focusing on. It wasn't until I got to Ireland that I fully understood the situation. Alone and apprehensive, I questioned my decision to go to Ireland, and the idea of joining the head office in London or New York became ever so tempting. But after my first meeting with Declan O'Rourke, the general manager of AIG in Ireland, this all changed. As if reading my mind, he said to me, "I know London and New York sound great, but I promise you it is only here that you will feel the heartbeat of our company." And so I channeled my energy into understanding the local business and what it meant to feel its heartbeat. For me, it was about seeing how my work fit in with the big picture. It was about being close to the action on the ground. It was about feeling connected with those around me whose collective heartbeat were in sync with mine. A simple advice, but I have used it ever since to guide my approach to work and to measure success. And so I present you the pulse test. How connected do you feel with your work? How connected do you feel with your team? And how connected do you feel with the purpose of your work? Thank you.
Thank you very much for that. I like the heartbeat of the company because often it's very fine to find the heart in a lot of companies, but I think it's more likely to find it at the front line or within the business units. So, I'd like to call the three speakers to take the chairs at the front. And if I can ask the speakers, when you do get a question, could you stand up to answer it so the people at the back can see you? Just in terms of hygiene, please be sure to raise your hand, wait for the microphone, and say your name and your company for recording purposes. And those on the webinar, the email address is webinar@actuaries.asn.au. Thank you. And there will be microphones. Microphones. So if people got questions, just put your hand up. But I'd probably like to start with the first question to Meng. How did you end up in Ireland? Like, why Ireland?
Good question. So I guess early on in my career. I knew that I wanted to experience working and living overseas. And why Ireland in particular? I guess it was a little bit about, you know, doing something a little bit different. So everyone was going to London and everyone in Ireland were coming here. But also, as with a lot of decisions, you know, there is a personal element in it, and that is I love poetry, and in particular the poetry of the great Irish poet William Butler Yeats. And so I guess there was this curiosity in me to see what it is about the country that inspired such beautiful poetry.
Thank you. Any questions from the audience?
Hello.
Sorry. Say your name. Yeah.
My name is Daniel. I'm from QBE. Just got a question. Thanks for your talk today. It's been quite inspirational. I just wanted to ask about, I guess, prioritizing in terms of work, in terms of who you listen to, the reports that you read, and I just wanted to ask about whether you've got a system developed to prioritize things, given that in this day and age there's a lot of information overload. I find there's so many reports out there in companies, there's so much data, so much things. How do you sort of prioritize what's the key things you need to get through?
I'll ask someone from the panel to take that one. If you stand up, please.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you, Daniel. That's a good question. And actually, there was something I was going to touch on in my presentation about priorities. There's the two areas of priority that I often think about. There's the day-to-day, or you could almost call it the hour-to-hour priorities, and I'll touch on those in a minute. But there's also the macro priorities as well. And one thing I did or do when I start a new role is actually sit right back and actually try and write down what are the top three priorities I think I need in this role. And it's a useful thing to do, because it's something that you can then stick with, and it gives you a bit of a guide throughout that day-to-day, week-to-week, month-to-month set of micro-priorities, and helps you keep fixed on things. So just as an example, when I became the appointed actuary of Zurich back in 2009, 2010, I remember writing myself a list, and the top priority, no prizes for guessing this, was solvency of the company. But hey, it's a good one to remember and to have there in that list on a post-it note in your top drawer. But you know, there are things like make sure you've got the best capital actuary you could have in that role. So that was the number one. Number two was the people. Make sure we've got a very good, well-engaged team. And number three was hitting the plan. But I think that's a good way of thinking of priorities in a macro way. Write a list, think about it, but come back to it. And that's the kind of list that saw me good for about 3 years in that role. Micro priorities, I think everybody has their own way of doing things. Mine has certainly helped you. I think as your career progresses, the amount of work, the amount of emails you get increases. I can see some nods, increases exponentially. But we do get the help of an executive assistant, or we can delegate more. So I would say delegate and learn to delegate quickly so things don't fill up in your inbox. And for me, just writing lists is good. And trusting and bouncing off the people who work for you what priority should be as well, because it's not my job always to prioritise. It's if I can get help in doing that, that's what I'll do. Thanks, Daniel.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Just a comment on that email thing. The company's not paying you to answer emails. It's paying you to do work. So if you can prioritise your email a bit better, it's always a good outcome. Yes.
Hi, I'm Velda. I'm from Aspen Re. I just want to ask, when do you actually decide that it's time to change, like time to move on to a different company? Is it always better when after you qualified?
I'm happy to take that one. So in my presentation, I didn't wait to qualify because for me it was taking years and I'm a bit of an impatient person. So I think it's personality driven as well, but also if an opportunity arises, you should definitely grab it. As actuaries, we're very used to looking at the data, and over the last few years I've been trying to listen to my gut more, which goes against all my training, but sometimes that actually does have the answer. So I hope that helps.
Yeah, I think that's pretty important. You really should assess every opportunity, and you're going to make mistakes too when you change roles, but the thing is you learn a lot from that and you learn what not to do next time. So thank you.
Hi, I'm Elliot from Deloitte. Mark, you touched on in your presentation the importance of communicating with non-actuaries. I'm just wondering if you've got any advice for setting the right amount of technical explanation in and setting the context with non-actuaries in explaining results.
Yeah, thank you.
Elliot.
Thanks, Elliot. The right amount of context or content in terms of technical versus non-technical. I mean, it really, really, really does depend on the person you're talking to. I mean, here's a really interesting story. So when I left, I left the appointed actuary role and moved to Hong Kong. I was involved in the recruitment of my successor. So this is a senior chief life actuary role, and I did interviews with a number of people, some really talented, really great people in my view, who'd done some amazing things and would have been fantastic for the actuarial function. And then our process involved the best of those people actually being interviewed, not by me as the exiting chief actuary, not by the CFO, but by the executive team. And it really surprised me, some of the feedback from the executive team. And don't forget, this is an executive team with people from HR, people from sales, people from operations, as well as a CFO and a CEO, et cetera, et cetera. And I always remember one of the comments from the head of HR, who was involved in that interview process and was actually involved in saying no to someone who I'd thought was a great candidate. And she said, "We can't put them in front of our regional office. We can't put that person in front because they've been too technical." And she didn't understand what they were talking about when they answered the questions. So I would say do pay a lot of attention to the audience themselves. Certainly don't overcomplicate, and certainly don't go into too much detail. And I've actually found less is more, believe it or not. Always remember that one. Less is more. And that's particularly the case if you're in a meeting or an executive team meeting or a board meeting where you don't control the agenda. There are people who want to move through points. And if they trust you, if they know what they're doing, if they trust you, you know what you're doing, they don't need the full explanation from you. They'll ask if they need to. So I hope that's helpful, Elliot.
Thanks.
Thanks.
We have a question from Brisbane. So that's good to see. Maybe Melbourne could probably send in a question too. That would be good too. It was mentioned previously about the importance of work-life balance. Any advice to those studying while working? That's from Dylan McCulloch. So any advice to those studying while working?
I can definitely take that. So I actually found that I was passing more the less I studied, which is actually counterintuitive. But it was, I think it was, I was failing, and then I actually decided to take up some hobbies. So I took up salsa dancing and running, and I think it's that time where you're not intensely looking at the textbook that you have your brain to, I guess, digest all that information. So that worked for me. It may not work for everyone, but I found that really useful. So I hope that helps. Dylan, was it?
Yeah, Dylan. Thank you, Dylan. Good to see Brisbane sort of asking questions. Solo, just how do people from interstate actually engage with the Institute? Because you've done a lot of volunteer work with the Institute, like through the Actuaries magazine and working groups. And how can people from interstate engage in the Institute from a distance?
Sure. So when I was working on the Actuaries magazine, we had a few people dial in from Melbourne. So unfortunately, they weren't able to enjoy the sandwiches that we got during the meeting. But we have pretty good teleconferencing facilities. So, and also a lot of things were done over email or, So technology, we're very lucky in that distance is no issue anymore.
Yep. Okay, good. Okay, we've got some mics.
Jessica from AIG here. This is a question inspired by Meng's talk. One of your three stages was the purpose stage, and I wondered if you all felt similarly that purpose is important in what you do and how you came to arrive at that purpose.
Hi, Jess. And I actually met Jess earlier today before the conference started, and I worked out that she actually worked at AIG in London, so I apologised to her in advance about my... what a small world it is. Thanks for your question. So on the question of purpose, I guess it's kind of... It's not something that a point in time you don't think about it and then suddenly... You know, or you think about, oh, what it is that I want to do. I guess it's always something in the back of your mind, but other priorities or other things might occupy your mind. So, for example, studying, and so you kind of, it's always, like I say, like searching for this purpose is always at the back of people's minds, but it might surface at different points in time for different people. So I guess for me, it was a combination of timing and then also having maybe tried a few different things already in the traditional space and then thinking about what next. And then when I did return from Ireland, then it sort of coincided with the start of the NDIS, and that's just when that was when everything, I guess, fitting together for me. And also joining my former team from PwC was a great bonus. The comfort net, I think, that Soleil talked about, that when you are taking that leap, it's good to have something that you do know and are comfortable in. So.
Okay, thank you.
So I have a question for Soleil and a question for Mark, but I'll start with Soleil first, if that's okay.
Name and company.
My name is Tim, I'm from KPMG. So my question for Soleil is that earlier today, obviously, we had Hibana came in. It was a startup 2 years ago, and then we talked about how actuaries are useful in that sense, but they're data-driven. You know, that kind of makes sense why actuaries are useful. So in your roles as an advisor to startups, how does your actuarial skill set actually apply, and how does the training actually help you to then help the startups?
Sure. So each project, I guess, is different. Definitely numeric skills help, but also I guess in our training we learn how to solve problems, and so every problem I have with the startups is just needs to be solved. So it's that the control cycle, I guess. Yeah, I'm using it every day with every project, and people don't call it the control cycle, although engineers will claim that they invented it. Anyway, that's another story. But the control cycle, definitely. But also, as I expanded and did other roles, it was also the non-actuarial skills that I'm learning that are now, I guess, sort of becoming part of my actuarial package and skill set that I can offer.
Yep, so maybe to add to my question, then what are the skills that you find that you had to learn to go into that kind of role, you know, on top of your actuarial training?
Well, as Mark mentioned, the communication one was absolutely key. So I remember very vividly when I was working with the strategic assistant role, you're dealing with so many executives, and some executives, they love the detail, and others, if you start with the detail, their eyes will just glaze and they'll be like, no. Or some of them are actually quite a bit of personality and will tell you to stop, get to the point. So you learn pretty quickly that it's not, you can't assume that everyone consumes data and information the same. Usually I like to start with the high level outcome, and then you can sort of tease out how much data, and they will also ask questions as well. So that's how it can come out.
Okay. Another question from Brisbane. This is for Mung and Mark. How or why did you decide to move on from consulting?
All right, thank you. Thank you, Brisbane. I actually worked as a consultant for Ernst & Young, but at Zurich for a period of months, and liked it so much that I joined the company, as they say. But I think, a bit more seriously, I think it does depend on the way you enjoy working and what really makes you tick in terms of work. And I think for me, as somebody working in an actuarial team in a corporate, you can really wrap your arms around a problem, you can really own a solution, and you can really see a piece of work right through to the end, so you can get right into the depth and see it all the way through. And just for me, and this is only me, as a consultant, it was great because I had a lot of experience of a lot of different areas of work, a lot of different companies, a lot of different people, but you did feel a little, you were sort of dancing around on the surface a little bit, and you never got that that real depth. And it was that depth that mattered to me, and that depth that I enjoyed working at Zurich. But also, as I touched on as well, as I became more senior in Zurich, it was that depth that I had to learn to let go of, which becomes its own issue if you can't let go as well, because you can't have that depth of knowledge about everything. You have to get to a point where you need to trust the people giving you the work and apply your own sense of quick judgment or sense of smell, as I said, and move on to the next problem quickly. Thanks, Brisbane.
Thank you.
So just quickly, my response to that. So at PwC, I remember, at least when I was there, the mantra was to always try and step in the shoes of your clients. And I guess having sort of heard about that and tried to apply that in my various projects that I worked at PwC, I guess I just really wanted to actually step into the shoes of the client and to just find out how it actually works. And funnily enough, at AIG, our auditors were PwC over in London, so it was very much the experience to be on the other side.
Yeah, thank you.
Hi, my name is Laura. I'm from Suncorp. So firstly, I want to thank all of you. Like, you done really great speech. I'm really inspired. And I guess I want to show this question to all of you. Obviously, you guys are really good speaker. I'm just wondering, is there any particular things you have done to improve your communication skills? Because I know, like, one big piece of advice I always receive is improve your communication skill, and communication skill is really important. So yeah, just wondering if you guys have done anything particular just to improve your communication skills. Thank you.
Well, first, Laura, you have great communication skills. So I think, I guess the advice would be practice, practice, practice. Like I said, things that are scary, just go for it. So if there's a paper you want to write or a presentation you want to do, maybe next year for next year's conference, Jenny, sounds like you might have a speaker. But it's just put yourself out there. And there's also, I haven't tried it, but there's something called Toastmasters, which I've heard is very good. And so that might be an avenue. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. I'd echo Salai's comments that practice is important. You have to throw yourself in at the deep end. A couple of things from my own experience that people don't actually notice that you're as nervous as you think you are. So don't forget that one. And keep things brief and simple, especially if you're communicating in a smaller environment as well. Thanks.
Thank you. The same here. I think practice. And just to throw in the mix, I think I'm sharing a little bit too much today, but another story. The very first presentation that I did when I was in primary school, when I recently arrived in Australia from China, I was born in China and only moved to Australia with no English at the age of 10. And I still remember that first presentation. It was absolutely petrifying, and the title of that presentation was Fear of Public Speaking. So
thank you very much.
Okay, thank you. And you work for Suncorp. That's actually, did you know that's a Brisbane based company? Sorry.
Hi, my question's for Mark, and I'm Freetham from Taylor Fry, I guess, for the record. So you said you chose to go to your kids' school on their first days. And I'm guessing your first one would have been a fair while back. So I'm guessing you would have been relatively junior at that point. So how did you say no to your bosses when they told you there was a report?
Yeah, so my first son was probably born when you were probably about... you didn't have that beard. I hope not, anyway. it was 2004 when my son was born, so I qualified in 2000, so I was working for Ernst & Young. We had reasonably flexible working conditions, and people understood. It was a great company, actually, in terms of that work-life balance. But I would say to everyone, don't be afraid of saying to your boss that you've got something important on. Make sure they appreciate that you'll still deliver what needs to be delivered, but I think they'll respect you for that. We have a saying in Zurich that it's not about presenteeism, it's about delivery. And I think that's reasonably self-evident what I mean. It's not about being seen to be in the office. It's about actually delivering what's needed and when. And it's about having trust with your teams, if you're a manager, but also trust up with your boss that you'll provide what's needed, and with flexible working arrangements, etc. That should be allowed to happen, regardless of whether your son's got their first day at school or not. Thanks.
Mm. Yeah, I think work's never that important. it's like nothing beats turning up at an assembly that your son never thought you were going to be at and seeing them beaming with a smile because you're there. So you always remember that. As I said, you won't remember the report. I've got another one, Tender.
Hi, I'm Joey, and I'm from the NDIA. I just got a question to Mark and another question to all three speakers. So, Mark, you mentioned you worked for a number of years in Hong Kong. So, did you find yourself experience any differences in terms of work culture, and did you have to adapt to a working environment that has a strong Asian influence? And I guess the second question to all three speakers would be, what are the top three qualities do you think are important to have to be successful in your position as an actuary or as a senior executive?
Yeah, thank you. Yes, there were differences. So I was responsible for Zurich's actuarial function across Asia. So the regional office was based in Hong Kong, but we had businesses in Japan, in Malaysia, in Taiwan, in Australia, of course, in Singapore, and the Isle of Man for some reason. So I won't go into that. No. It was very interesting because I did not manage the chief actuaries in the countries, but needed to be able to ask them to do things that they didn't necessarily have to do because they had their own CFOs who were their bosses. So that concept of influencing and mutual respect was very important. And I think This would be my interpretation as Guaylo of this. Is I really do think that the guys I worked with, whether they were the guys in Japan or Mr. Koo in Malaysia, or you know, the Danny Chow in Hong Kong, the guys really wanted to engage a little bit socially, or not just in the office. And certainly when the food's as good as in Hong Kong and in Malaysia and Japan, that was a pleasure to get to know the people like that. I think as well, one other observation I had that I hadn't fully appreciated until I worked in Hong Kong was in the actual office itself. It's quite hierarchical. I think there was a slight sort of tendency not to want to engage with senior people the same way an Australian might just walk into the boss's office and have a chat. So from my perspective, that meant I had to make an extra effort to engage with the guys. I mean, I remember when we were renovating and my office was being used, and I was sitting with the rest of the team, and that was fantastic. I learned some Cantonese as well, which was good. Mostly things like Gao Chor, Aya, Homa Fan. But I think engaging closely was good as well. I think, and those relationships have been very, very deep relationships that I still have with many of those ladies and gentlemen still. So it's been very valuable and very great for me as well to have had that experience.
Okay.
The 3 points? I think they're probably the things that I touched on before. I think that mutual respect between yourself and everybody in your team is critical. I think making time for everybody is important as well, and that does include making time for yourself and your family. And I think it's important as well to remember you're working for a business and there are important outcomes as well. So whatever your business is, work out how that business runs financially and be good at A grade for being good at your job as well. Understand the drivers of your business, understand what's important to your boss, understand what's important to the different stakeholders, and keep an eye on the horizon as well for what's coming up in the future. That's some quick things off the top of my head, but very good questions. Thank you.
Does anyone?
Yeah, so I guess my three things would be, the first is to do it with your heart. To do anything well, I think your heart has to be in it. And secondly, that foundation that I talked about, I think it is so important. It will pay off later on. I think if you focus early on to really build up your technical capability. And thirdly, I guess it does come down to communication, because there is no point in having all this knowledge and these ideas if you can't communicate them effectively and put them into effective use.
Do you want to say anything?
I think the two of them just summed it up, so.
Okay, thank you.
Hi, my name is Christine from ANP. So I lived in Brisbane for 3 years before coming to Sydney.
Brisbane.
And Zurich was also my first employer right after uni, so I'm deeply connected to the speaker.
See me later.
So my question is, at the early stage of your career, did you reach out to seek for mentorship, and how that helped you further develop in your career? Thank you. It's a general question.
Well, I guess in the early years of my actuarial career, the idea of a mentor was just starting to be spruiked by the Institute. So that was actually good timing when I thought, oh, okay, I'll go and seek one. And I sought one from, I think I was in reserving at the time, and I asked a senior pricing actuary to. And then over the years, I've asked more and more people, and got a lawyer, and there's a psychologist, and there's lots of different people. But yeah, I think early on in your career, it's very helpful, because it's always useful to learn from other people's experiences.
might find.
Sorry, this will be the last question. Unless Jenny, you want to be...
Okay. This is for Mark and Salai, kind of a hybrid question. My name is Kalon from Zurich, it's general address. Sorry about that. Mark, what you said about developing an instinct really resonates with me, and it's something I believe in. And it seems like a bit of a differentiator for a role that you would subsequently transition into like Salai's. A strategic assistant role, maybe. But have you any advice on how you recognize the extent to which you've developed that skill before you jump ship and transition out of an actuarial role?
Yeah, a tough one. Because it's something that evolves over time. I think, as I touched on briefly in what I said, I think having that technical grounding is so important. And, you know, we all know when we're doing technical work, and we all know when we could just send something off when we haven't completely understood it, or we could look through the formulae and keep tracing things through, or look through the profit code, which is something we use in life insurance, and try and fully understand it. And I was always the person who liked to get the depth. I think the other thing that had helped me in getting that instinct or sense of smell with the numbers was the people I was working with as well. I mean, there are a lot of actuarial huddles that go on around computers in the companies I've worked in, and that's where you really get to discuss interesting problems, concepts, when you don't fully understand numbers and really get to grips with them and dive into the detail. And I think doing that for a period of years is something that helps really cement that sense of smell. So I can't tell you when you feel ready, probably when you get bored with the formulae, maybe that's a sign that it's time to let go a little bit and move up and start focusing on other things. But do engage in those conversations, and for me it was that interest in the depth that I think helped me. Thank you.
Okay. Yeah, thank you very much. And just in terms of thank you from the Institute, I'd like to give you each a bottle of wine. Hopefully this will find your heart for you. And if everyone could just give a round of applause to these speakers. We've come to the time, before we hand over to Barry Rafe to close the conference, I'd like to invite the practice committee representatives to come to the lectern to introduce themselves and their practice area. And thank you very much again. Thank you.
Hi everybody, I'm Hugh. You might know me from classic young actuary conference moments like plenary number one and that guy who got the last turkey and cranberry sandwich. So I think this time now so members from the different practice committees at the Institute are coming up just to chat about what we do, and so you get a bit of a view as to how the Actuaries Institute is working for you and all those other things that we pretend to do. So I'm here in my position as a member of the Data Analytics Working Group. So we're a group that talk about data analytics and how to promote it in the profession. And in terms of things we actually do, the main thing we do is we have an existential crisis every meeting as to whether data analytics is a skill that needs to be taught across everything or whether it's its own practice area. Which is sort of a key question because it affects how you do education and how you sort of label people, which is relevant. Once we've solved that, then our next crisis is whether we're data analytics or whether we're artificial intelligence working group or whether we're machine learning working group. So once we've solved the important issues, then the things we actually do We do a one-day conference every year, so there's a data analytics day a bit like this one. So we've been doing that for 3 years, and so we'll do another one this year, which will be great. We've tried to run sort of study groups for MOOC courses, so online sort of free courses or cheap courses you can do as a way of sort of helping people to chat to others and study together if they want to learn more about analytics and they don't get that at work. We also have organised a couple of Kaggle competitions as a way of sort of encouraging actuaries to play in that space. And of course, a lot of these things don't require the Institute's help for you to do them. So if you are interested in analytics, just sort of get into it. But the Institute is sort of very aware that analytics is in many ways the future and wants to make sure that particularly young people who are smart, intelligent and have time compared to old people who are the opposite of those things have the opportunity to sort of be supported a little bit in data analytics. So the other thing that we've done is we've created a new working group called the Young Data Analytics Working Group. And so there's a bunch of sort of quite enthusiastic people doing a few things as well. So pay attention. So there are things happening in that space at the Institute. And so it's a good thing. And we do understand that analytics is important to particularly a lot of young people who have come through the university degrees.
It's quite intimidating to be faced by this many young people. I actually qualified last millennium. That's how old I am. So I'm here today to represent the GIPC committee. So I guess in my role, I'm a reinsurance broker. So I work for a sort of global broking firm. So you can tell by accent, I'm a native Australian. And what we do is we place the largest all perils cat program from the Sydney office. It's globally. There's only two bigger cat programs that's to do with earthquakes, including the Earthquake Commission in California and Japan. What we do on the GIPC, we're more established. I'm probably old enough to remember when actually didn't have to do general insurance as an exam. That was a long time ago. So there was once a time when general insurance was seen as a new area for actuaries. There was once a time when generalised linear models were new, and they used to take about 15 years to run. So that influenced the work. But what we do on the GIPC, we meet monthly. There's about 16 of us on the committee, and unfortunately, there's no one in the audience because I guess we're all old, which is a shame because the future of the profession really is you guys, and it's up to you to get into those new areas and keep pushing. So we go through professional standards, so there's updates to be made on that. So you may have seen recently we had a call for volunteers to rewrite the other accumulations vertical requirement note. We wrote it 5 years ago. We didn't even mention cyber. So we've got to keep things moving forwards. We look into doing areas of research, so Jonathan Cohen does that. We would draft responses on the behalf of the Institute to do with schemes like New South Wales, CTP reform. Hopefully you've all got your refunds, which I knew all about it and then was surprised when I got a refund, which I shouldn't have been. It was quite amazing. What's this? Oh, I know. also, ACT, CTP schemes. We liaise with APRA because the GI space is, there's capital work there. And if we're going to revise notes or they're going to issue guidance, we like to know how they're going to interpret what we say. They like to not tell us and say it's up to you and up to interpret. So that's always fun and games. And also CPD seminars. So we do the GI conferences later this year in about November. So we're always looking for speakers and volunteers. So Bojang, who's not here, who volunteered me for this, and he's not here, so I'll mention that to him. So he organises the GI committee, the insight sessions you'll see, and there's sometimes we have these, we've recently done a natural cat conference as well. So we're sort of behind the scenes making sure all this happens. Often we do a good amount of the work, but we're always looking for volunteers to help us. We do a sort of members liaison bit where we try and draft new articles on things that move things forwards and hopefully raise the reputation of actuaries above and beyond perhaps the standard roles. Education, trying to make sure that you guys are learning what you need, and that's my responsibility on the sort of Institute, so I'm really interested in that area. So I've moved off probably into a wider field area sort of via an MBA, and I think it's crucial that we keep up to date. So the data analytics stuff is really key to that. And then that's broadly speaking what we're doing. So current topics would be the Terrorism Acts being reformed, so they'll be looking for input and we'll probably put some input. We've got cyber terror coming up. The Royal Commission seems to be generating a lot of issues. So basically we try and represent the GI space where there's lots of change all the time, which makes it interesting. We always have we don't have a younger subcommittee. We do always have a young person that comes to the committee. We ask them what they think, and we sit there when they start using all these words we've never heard of. But it's great. Thank you very much.
Hi everyone. My name's Ignatius. I'm a director. Those giggling probably work with me very closely. That's probably why they're trying to control their laughter at the moment. So I'm representing Health Practice Committee. Emphasis on health. It's not Health Insurance Practice Committee. It's Health Practice Committee, because absolutely, as a group of health actuaries, we believe strongly that the actuarial profession has a role to play beyond just private health insurance. So thinking about what kind of provisioning vehicles, how you go about funding healthcare, whether that's in private sector or public sector or through private health insurance or through other means. So as a committee, you know, one of the things that we really challenge ourselves is how can we promote the actuarial profession within the broader health space, and not just within health insurance. So my specific role on the Health Practice Committee is as the industry liaison officer. So what I do in that role is really just making sure that across the health sector, actuaries are putting forward their views and understanding the views of other stakeholders in the industry. I think the healthcare sector is a very interesting area to be working in. It's actually very political. So any kind of changes to government policy, there's always a lot of grief, whether that's the health insurers or the medical professions. And you may have seen last night on ABC, there was a Four Corners report on out-of-pocket bills. That's a very hot topic in the industry at the moment. So these are all kind of issues that the health sector is facing, and how and the health committee, health practice committee, needs to be on top of, you know, how the industry should react and how we can support private health insurers, but also think about what genuinely is the right approach to solving some of these funding issues. So I think I was also asked to talk about what the practice committee does. So we've got quite a few people on the committee. There's a number of different roles. So we've got someone who looks after the professional standards. Quite recently, when we moved from being regulated by FIAC to APRA, we had to rewrite all the standards again. It wasn't as simple as just replacing FIAC with APRA. It kind of got a little bit more complicated than that. So we've got an APRA liaison as well. We've got a communications officer. We've got someone who's looking after events. So we try and put on insight session on a fairly regular basis, and have interesting topics, you know, to encourage understanding of the health sector and encouraging more of you to work in this space. And we're also organising seminars. So we've got the Future of Health seminar, which is happening in October later this year. So that's ongoing. Other things that we do, we look after the online education course. So that's one of the modules, I believe, that you can study to get through your qualifications at the moment. So, you know, behind the scenes, there are people who mark that online course and keep it current. Other things that we do, we look at what's happening internationally. So we've got someone who also talks to our colleagues in the other international actuarial professions in terms of what's happening in the health space. And we also have a specific person at the moment who's looking after the private health insurance reforms, because that's very topical at the moment. So yeah, that's a couple of the things that we do, and you know, we're very busy, and feel free to come and talk to me afterwards if you want to know more. Thanks.
Hi everyone, my name is Susan Louie. I'm from ANZ Wealth, and I'm the convener of the Risk Management Practice Committee, or the RMPC. We've left the best till last, which is risk, which is actually an area that encompasses all of those industries that you've just heard about, be it life, general insurance, health, and other industries. What do we know about risk? I mean, there are actually not many actuaries in the field of risk management. It is actually, I think, one of the truly emerging areas as a potential area of employment, interest for young actuaries like yourselves, and really the world is your oyster, and I would encourage you to really explore as many of these different areas that you've just heard about, which include risk management. My remit is to talk about what the RMPC does and also what happens in risk management. So starting with the first, with the former. The RMPC at the moment is busy doing a few things. One of them is looking at international practice standards for risk management. I mean, it's very much an international thing on the risk front because it is such a relatively new and emerging field. There are a whole bunch of standards, including modelling standards, enterprise risk management standards and things like that. And we're looking to see how they might translate to an Australian context. It's important work because it really sets a precedent of the foundations for actuarial practice in this area, and we hope to grow that and increase prominence of that going forward. Another thing that the Risk Management Practice Committee does is, I mean, you've heard everyone talk about events, and events is actually a really good forum for you to find out more about things. So the risk event, our flagship event, happens in September, and it's one of the unusual events where I think more than around 50% or maybe more than 50% of the attendees of the events actually come from the non-actuarial profession, okay? And that's something that we are proud of, we want to continue, because we have twofold objectives here in terms of the RMPC. One is to promote risk management as a viable career path for young actuaries like yourself. And two, actually, is to extend, if you like, put a flagship Actuaries Institute presence out there to potential employers and possibly other companies in industries which are not normally associated with insurance companies or you know, the areas that we would normally work in. So it's a really good thing for us to actually extend that event to non-practitioners because they are potentially hirers of actuaries and risk management going forward. Very briefly now, what happens in the day of a life of a risk officer, I suppose? My days are really busy. I mean, coming from ANZ Wealth, it's a division which truly covers all lines of financial business. So we have a large life insurance operation, which is OnePath Life. We've got OnePath General Insurance, which is a smaller general insurance player. We also have Lenders Mortgage Insurance, which is basically a captive that deals with the tail end of banking risk, which is all the risky loans that we might make to homeowners out there. We also have an advice and distribution business, a superannuation investment business. The list goes on and on. It's actually a true conglomerate of a division. What's particularly interesting for me are things like margin lending, which I don't think many people get involved in, but it's actually a fascinating area in terms of how much would we lend to customers in terms of extending credit to them for them to buy shares on which our security is based on. So that poses interesting valuation and risk assessment issues, which I think not many actuaries have seen, but I see, and I think it's fascinating, right? Rest of my days, they're filled with board meetings. We deal a lot with boards and risk management, probably too much given the Royal Commission and the context surrounding us now. But certainly something that is actually, right now what's happening is great for board discussions and talking about really how we truly manage risk, especially reputation risk, which is what many corporations are dealing with. I'm also a director of some boards and chair of some of them. And last but not least, we've got the regulator. I don't know who's here from APRA or ASIC. Oh, good, it's no one here. I mean, they're my best friends. but seriously, it's a relationship that's constantly evolving, and they're really important business partners to us. I see them as a business stakeholder just like any other stakeholder. I don't think anyone should treat them otherwise, which is have a respectful relationship. At the same time, we have our customers' interests and our policyholder interests as well as, you know, our own interests as well to consider. I might just stop then really in terms of what I do. I would be here for really the best part of your conference, which is, of course, for you. The networking drinks are going to come afterwards. Hopefully we can talk further then. For those of you who want to know a little bit more about risk management as an alternative career path, there is a podcast we've put out where we had a risk officer discussion. I've put out a podcast with Gavin Pearce, who is the Chief Risk Officer of iCare, where you might hear a little bit about what else happens in the risk management world. I think that's it from me, and I think we're right on time at 5 o'clock, which means it's over to Barry. Okay? Thank you.
Hello, I'm Barry. Thanks, Susan, for saying that you're saving the best to last, because that's me. So I'm from the old actuaries program. You haven't heard of that, have you? I mean, you're surprised, I can tell. You know, I don't look that old, but, you know. So I'm the president, and I'm happy to be here today. And in fact, I do director training, company director training. So I've been training directors all day. And I'm going to tell you something which is a bit shocking. And that is that most directors of insurers and banks don't understand financial statements. So legally you're required to be financially literate. Yet banks and insurers are so complex that you can't expect to get customer representatives and IT people on those organisations and expect them to understand the financial statements. And I think we're seeing the implications of that come through now in that they're all complicated and got people like us understand them. But a lot of people don't, and I think that's a very important future for the actuarial profession. So I'd like to thank everybody for coming, and the sponsors, SKL and Finity. And I'd like to invite Angela Poon from Finity and Eliza Yao, is it, from SKL, to get a little certificate. Are you here? Yes. I've got a picture of me and Lee. Apparently, yes. There you go, congratulations, thank you. Oh, there it is over there. That's a long way away.
Makes you look younger.
Makes me look younger. Yes. Thank you. Oh, any closer now? You can crop me out later as well. Thank you. Thanks very much. Thanks very much for that. Thank you again to PwC for supporting the Brisbane webinar and AIA for supporting the Melbourne webinar. Don't forget feedback form. So we like feedback. So make sure you fill in the feedback and you'll be getting an email about that shortly as well. I'd like to thank the speakers. I'd like to thank the chairs. We all do this for nothing, you know, don't you? You know that, didn't you? Yep. So thank the speakers and the chairs for their efforts. Oh, I've lost a piece of paper. It's all right, I've got one here. Spare one, sorry. It's my first day on the job. So I'd like to thank the organising committee. Tim Lamb, Jenny Lyon, Angela Poon, Claire White, Fin Ying Ting, Zoe Yang, Christina Liao, Sid Jane, Veronica Tay, and Chetana Kaganti. Thank you to the Institute On-Site Events team and the HQ people. And we look forward to seeing you all again at various events in the future. Networking is good. So we've got drinks until 6 o'clock. So thank you very much. Thank you.